see why I should care. This could change the world, Bila, Eshonai said. If Venli is right, and she can bond with this Spren and come out with anything other than dull form, well, at the very least, we will have an entirely new form to choose. At the greatest, we will have power to control the storms and tap their energy.
So she will try this personally? Thud asked, to the rhythm of winds, the rhythm that they used to judge when a high storm was near.
If the five give her permission. They were to discuss it and make their decision today. That's great, Bila said. But will it help me kill humans?
Eshonai attuned mourning.
If storm form is truly one of the ancient powers, Bila, then yes, it will help you kill humans. Many of them.
Good enough for me, then, Bila said. Why are you so worried?
The ancient powers are said to have come from our gods.
Who cares? If the gods would help us kill those armies out there, then I'd swear to them right now.
Don't say that, Bila, Eshonai said to reprimand. Never say anything like that.
The woman quieted, tossing the stone onto the table. She hummed softly to skepticism.
That walked the line of insubordination.
Eshonai met Bila's eyes and found herself softly humming to resolve. Thud glanced from Bila to Eshonai.
Food?
He asked.
Is that your answer to every disagreement? Eshonai asked, breaking her song.
It's hard to argue with your mouth full, Thud said.
I'm sure I've seen you do just that, Bila said, many times.
The arguments end happy, though, Thud said, because everyone is full. So, food?
Fine, Bila said, glancing at Eshonai. The two withdrew. Eshonai sat down at the table feeling drained. When had she started worrying if her friends were insubordinate? It was this horrid uniform. She picked up the gemstone, staring into its depths. It was a large one, about a third the size of her fist, though gemstones didn't have to be large to trap a Spren inside. She hated trapping them. The right way was to go into the high storm with the proper attitude, singing the proper song to attract the proper Spren. You bonded it in the fury of the raging storm and were reborn with a new body. People had been doing this from the arrival of the first winds. The listeners had learned that capturing Spren was possible from the humans, then had figured out the process on their own. A captive Spren made the transformation much more reliable. Before, there had always been an element of chance. You could go into the storm wanting to become a soldier, and come out a mate instead.
This is progress, Eshonai thought, staring at the little smoky Spren inside the stone. Progress is learning to control your world, put up walls to stop the storms, choose when to become a mate. Progress was taking nature and putting a box around it. Eshonai pocketed the gemstone and checked the time. Her meeting with the rest of the five wasn't scheduled until the third movement of the Rhythm of Peace, and she had a good half a movement until then. It was time to speak with her mother. Eshonai stepped out into Narak and walked along the path, nodding to those who saluted. She passed mostly soldiers. So much of their population wore war form these days, their small population. Once there had been hundreds of thousands of listeners scattered across these plains. Now a fraction remained. Even then, the listeners had been a united people. Oh, there had been divisions, conflicts, even wars among their factions, but they had been a single people, those who had rejected their gods and sought freedom in obscurity. Bila no longer cared about their origins. There would be others like her, people who ignored the danger of the gods and focused only on the fight with the humans. Eshonai passed dwellings, ramshackle things constructed of hardened creme over frames of shell, huddled in the leeward shadow of lumps of stone. Most of those were empty now. They'd lost thousands to war over the years. We do have to do something, she thought, attuning the rhythm of peace in the back of her mind. She sought comfort in its calm, soothing beats, soft and blended, like a caress. Then she saw the dull forms. They looked much like what the humans called parshmen, though they were a little taller and not nearly as stupid. Still, dull form was a limiting form, without the capacities and advantages of newer forms. There shouldn't have been any here. Had these people bonded the wrong spren by mistake? It happened sometimes. Eshonai strode up to the group of three, two femalen and one malen. They were hauling rock buds harvested on one of the nearby plateaus, plants which had been encouraged to grow quickly by use of stormlight-infused gems.
What is this? Eshonai asked. Did you choose this form in error? Or are you new spies?
They looked at her with insipid eyes. Eshonai attuned anxiety. She'd once tried dull form. She had wanted to know what their spies would suffer. Trying to force concepts through her brain had been like trying to think rationally while in a dream.
Did someone ask you to adopt this form? Eshonai said, speaking slowly and clearly.
Nobody asked it, the Malan said to no rhythm at all. His voice sounded dead. We did it.
Why? Eshonai said. Why would you do this?
Humans won't kill us when they come, the Malan said, hefting his rock bud and continuing on his way.
The others joined him without a word. Eshonai gaped, the rhythm of anxiety strong in her mind. A few fear spren like long purple worms dove in and out of the rock nearby, collecting toward her until they crawled up out of the ground around her. Forms could not be commanded. Every person was free to choose for themselves. Transformations could be cajoled and requested, but they could not be forced. Their gods had not allowed this freedom, so the listeners would have it, no matter what. These people could choose dull form if they wished. Eshonai could do nothing about it. Not directly. She hastened her pace. Her leg still ached from her wound, but was healing quickly. One of the benefits of war form. She could almost ignore the damage at this point. A city full of empty buildings, and Eshonai's mother chose a shack on the very edge of the city, almost fully exposed to the storms. Mother worked her shale bark rose outside, humming softly to herself to the rhythm of peace. She wore work form. She'd always preferred it. Even after nimble form had been discovered, Mother had not changed. She had said she didn't want to encourage people to see one form as more valuable than another, that such stratification could destroy them. Wise words. The type Eshonai hadn't heard out of her mother in years.
Child, Mother said as Eshonai approached.
Solid, despite her years, Mother had a neat, round face and wore her hair strands in a braid tied with a ribbon. Eshonai had brought her that ribbon from a meeting with the Alethi years ago.
Child, have you seen your sister? It is her day of first transformation. We need to prepare her.
It is attended to, Mother, Eshonai said to the rhythm of peace, kneeling down beside the woman. How goes the pruning?
I should be finishing soon, Mother said. I need to leave before the people who own this house return.
You own it, Mother.
No, it belongs to two others. They were in the house last night and told me I needed to leave. I'll just finish with this shale bark before I go.
She got out her file, smoothing one side of a ridge, then painting it with sap to encourage growth in that direction. Eshonai sat back, attuning mourning, and peace left her. Perhaps she should have chosen the rhythm of the lost instead. It changed in her head. She forced it back.
No. No, her mother was not dead. She wasn't fully alive, either.
Here, take this, Mother said to Peace, handing Eshonai a file. At least Mother recognized her today. Work on that outcropping there. I don't want it to keep growing downward. We need to send it up, up toward the light.
The storms are too strong on this side of the city.
Storms? Nonsense. No storms here.
Mother paused.
I wonder where we'll be taking your sister. She'll need a storm for her transformation.
Don't worry about that, Mother, Eshonai said, forcing herself to speak to Peace. I will care for it.
You are so good, Venli, Mother said. So helpful. Staying home, not running off like your sister. That girl. She's never where she should be.
She is now, Eshonai whispered. She's trying to be.
Mother hummed to herself, continuing working. Once this woman had one of the best memories in the city. She still did, in a way.
Mother, Eshonai said, I need help. I think something terrible is going to happen. I can't decide if it is less terrible than what is already happening.
Mother filed at a section of shale bark, then blew off the dust.
Our people are crumbling, Eshonai said. We're being weathered away. We moved to Narok and chose a war of attrition. That has meant 6 years with steady losses. People are giving up.
That's not good, Mother said.
But the alternative? Dabbling in things we shouldn't? Things that might bring the eyes of the unmade upon us?
You're not working, Mother said, pointing. Don't be like your sister.
Eshonai placed her hands in her lap.
This wasn't helping. Seeing Mother like this... Mother, Eshonai said to supplication, why did we leave the dark home?
Ah, now that's an old song, Eshonai, Mother said. A dark song, not for a child like you. Why, it's not even your day of first transformation.
I'm old enough, Mother. Please.
Mother blew on her shale bark. Had she forgotten finally this last part of what she had been? Eshonai's heart sank.
Long are the days since we knew the dark home, Mother sang softly to one of the rhythms of remembrance. The last legion, that was our name then. Warriors who had been set to fight in the farthest plains, this place that had once been a nation and was now rubble. Dead was the freedom of most people. The forms unknown were forced upon us. Forms of power, yes, but also forms of obedience. The gods commanded, and we did obey, always, always.
Except for that day, Eshonai said along with her mother, in rhythm.
The day of the storm when the last legion fled, Mother continued in song. Difficult was the path chosen. Warriors touched by the gods, our only choice to seek dullness of mind, a crippling that brought freedom.
Mother's calm, sonorous song danced with the wind. As frail as she seemed other times, when she sang the old songs, she seemed herself again. A parent who had at times conflicted with Eshonai, but a parent whom Eshonai had always respected.
Daring was the challenge made, Mother sang, when the last legion abandoned thought and power in exchange for freedom. They risked forgetting all, and so songs they composed, 100 stories to tell, to remember. I tell them to you, and you will tell them to your children, until the forms are again discovered.
From there, Mother launched into one of the early songs about how the people would make their home in the ruins of an abandoned kingdom, how they would spread out, act as simple tribes and refugees. It was their plan to remain hidden, or at least ignored. The songs left out so much.
The last Legion hadn't known how to transform into anything other than dull form and mate form, at least not without the help of the gods. How had they known the other forms were possible? Had these facts originally been recorded in the songs, and then lost over the years, as words changed here and there? Eshonai listened, and though her mother's voice did help her attune peace again, she found herself deeply troubled anyway. She had come here for answers. Once, that would have worked. No longer. Eshonai stood to leave her mother singing. "I found some of your things," Mother said, breaking the song. "When cleaning today, you should take them. They clutter the home and I will be moving out soon." Eshonai hummed mourning to herself, but went to see just what her mother had discovered. Another pile of rocks, in which she saw child's playthings. Strips of cloth she imagined were clothing. Eshonai found a small sack in front of the building. She opened it to find paper. Paper made from local plants, not human paper. Rough paper with varied color, made after the old listener way. Textured and full, not neat and sterile. The ink on it was beginning to fade, but Eshonai recognized the drawings. "My maps," she thought, "from those early days." Without meaning to, she attuned remembrance. Days spent hiking across the wilderness of what the humans called Natanatan, passing through forests and jungles, drawing her own maps and expanding the world. She'd started alone, but her discoveries had excited an entire people. Soon, though still in her teenage years, she'd been leading entire expeditions to find new rivers, new ruins, new spren, new plants, and humans. In a way, this was all her fault. Her mother started singing again. Looking through her old maps, Eshonai found a powerful longing within her. Once, she'd seen the world as something fresh and exciting, new, like a blossoming forest after a storm. She was dying slowly, as surely as her people were. She packed up the maps and left her mother's house, walking toward the center of town. Her mother's song, still beautiful, echoed behind her. Eshonai attuned peace. That let her know that she was nearly late for the meeting with the rest of the five. She did not hasten her pace. She let the steady sweeping beats of the rhythm of peace carry her forward. Unless you concentrated on attuning a certain rhythm, your body would naturally choose the one that fit your mood. Therefore, it was always a conscious decision to listen to a rhythm that did not match how you felt. She did this now with peace. The listeners had made a decision centuries ago, a decision that set them back to primitive levels. Choosing to murder Gavilar Kolin had been an act to affirm that decision of their ancestors. Eshonai had not then been one of their leaders, but they had listened to her counsel and given her the right to vote among them. The choice, horrible though it seemed, had been one of courage. They'd hoped that a long war would bore the Alethi. Eshonai and the others had underestimated Alethi greed. The gem hearts had changed everything. In the center of town, near the pool, was a tall tower that remained proudly erect in defiance of centuries worth of storms. Once there had been steps within, but Krem leaking in windows had filled the building up with rock, so workers had carved steps running around its outside. Eshonai started up the steps, holding to the chain for safety. It was a long but familiar climb. Though her leg ached, war form had great endurance, though it required more food than any other form to keep it strong. She made it to the top with ease. She found the other members of the five waiting for her, one member wearing each known form. Eshonai for war form, Davim for work form, Abranai for mate form, Chivi for nimble form, and the quiet Zuln for dull form. Venli waited as well with her once mate, though he was flushed from the difficult climb. Nimble form, though good for many delicate activities, did not have great endurance. Esh and I stepped up onto the flat top of the once tower, wind blowing against her from the east. There were no chairs up here, and the five sat on the bare rock itself. Davim hummed to annoyance. With the rhythms in one's head, it was difficult to be late by accident. They rightly suspected that Esh and I had dallied. She sat on the rock and took the spren-filled gemstone from her pocket, setting it on the ground in front of her. The violet stone glowed with stormlight.
"I'm worried about this test," Esh and I said. "I do not think we should allow it to proceed."
"What?" Venli said to anxiety. "Sister, don't be ridiculous. Our people need this."
Davim leaned forward, arms on his knees. He was broad-faced, his work-form skin marbled mostly of black, with tiny swirls of red here and there.
"If this works, it will be an amazing advance, the first of the forms of ancient power rediscovered." "These forms are tied to the gods," Esh and I said. "What if in choosing this form we invite them to return?"
Venli hummed irritation. "In the old day, all forms came from the gods. We have found that nimble form does not harm us. Why would storm form?"
"It is different," Esh and I said. "Sing the song. Hum it to yourself. Its coming brings the gods their night. The ancient powers are dangerous."
"Men have them," Abranai said.
He wore mate form, lush and plump, though he controlled its passions. Esh and I had never envied him the position. She knew from private conversations that he would have preferred to have another form. Unfortunately, others who held mate form either did so transiently or did not possess the proper solemnity to join the five.
"You yourself brought us the report, Esh and I," Abranai continued. "You saw a warrior among the Alethi using ancient powers, and many others confirmed it to us. Surge bindings have returned to men. The Spren again betray us."
"If surge bindings are back," Davim said to consideration, "then it might indicate that the gods are returning anyway. If so, we'd best be prepared to deal with them. Forms of power will help with that."
"We don't know they will come," Esh and I said to resolve. "We don't know any of this. Who knows if men even have surge bindings? It might be one of the honor blades. We left one in Alethkar that night."
Chivi hummed to skepticism. Her nimble form face had elongated features, her hair strands tied back in a long tail.
"We are fading as a people. I passed some today who had taken dull form and not to remember our past. They did so because they worried that men would kill them otherwise. They prepare themselves to become slaves."
"I saw them too," Davim said to resolve. "We must do something, Esh and I. Your soldiers are losing this war, beat by beat."
"The next storm," Venli said. She used the rhythm of pleading. "I can test this at the next storm."
Esh and I closed her eyes. Pleading. It was a rhythm not often attuned. It was hard to deny her sister in this.
"We must be unified in this decision," Davim said. "I will accept nothing else. Esh and I, do you insist on objecting? Will we need to spend hours here making this decision?"
She took a deep breath, coming to a decision that had been working its way through the back of her mind. The decision of an explorer. She glanced at the sack of maps she'd set on the floor beside her.
"I will agree to this test," Esh and I said.
Nearby, Venli hummed to appreciation. "However," Esh and I continued to resolve,
"I must be the one who tries the new form first."
All humming stopped. The others of the five gaped at her.
"What?"
Venli said.
"Sister, no. It is my right.
You are too valuable, Eshonai said. You know too much about the forms, and much of your research is held only in your head. I'm simply a soldier. I can be spared if this goes wrong.
You are a shard bearer,
Davim said.
Our last.
Thud has trained with my blade and plate, Eshonai said. I will leave both with him just in case. The others of the five hummed to consideration.
This is a good suggestion, Abranai said. Eshonai has both strength and experience.
It was my discovery, Venli said to irritation.
And you are appreciated for it, Davim said. But Eshonai is right. You and your scholars are too important to our future. More than that, Abranai added, you are too close to the project, Venli. The way you speak makes that clear. If Eshonai enters the storms and discovers that something is off about this form, she can halt the experiment and return to us.
This is a good compromise, Chivi said, nodding. Are we in agreement?
I believe so, Abranai said, turning towards Zuln.
The representative of the Dullforms rarely spoke. She wore the smock of a parshman and had indicated that she considered it her duty to represent them, those with no songs, along with any Dullforms among them. Hers was as noble a sacrifice as Abranai holding to mate form. More so. Dullform was a difficult form to suffer, one that only a few ever experienced for longer than a storm pause or so.
I agree to this, Zuln said.
The others hummed to appreciation. Only Venli did not join in the song. If this storm form turned out to be real, would they add another person to the five? At first, the five had all been dull forms, then all workers. It was only at the discovery of nimble form that it had been decided that they would have one of each form. A question for later. The others of the five stood up, then began to make their way down the long flight of steps, spiraling around the tower. Wind blew from the east, and Eshonai turned toward it, looking out over the broken plains, toward the origin of storms. During a coming high storm, she would step into the winds and become something new. Something powerful. Something that would change the destiny of the listeners and perhaps the humans forever.
I nearly had cause to hate you, sister, Venli said to reprimand, idling beside where Eshonai sat.
I did not forbid this test, Eshonai said.
Instead you take its glory.
If there is glory to be had, Eshonai said to reprimand, it will be yours for discovering the form. That should not be a consideration. Only our future should matter.
Venli hummed to irritation.
They call you wise, experienced. It makes one wonder if they've forgotten who you were, that you went off recklessly into the wilds, ignoring your people while I stayed home and memorized songs. When did everyone start believing you were the responsible one?
It's this cursed uniform, Eshonai thought, rising.
Why didn't you tell us what you were researching? You let me believe your studies were to find art form or mediation form. Instead, you were looking for one of the forms of ancient power.
Does that matter?
Yes. It makes all the difference, Venli. I love you, but your ambition frightens me.
You don't trust me, Venli said to Betrayal.
Betrayal? That was a song rarely sung. It stung enough to make Eshonai wince.
We'll see what this form does, Eshonai said, picking up her maps and the gemstone with the trapped spren. Then we will talk further. I just want to be careful.
You want to do it yourself, Venli said to irritation. You always want to be first. But enough. It is done. Come with me. I will need to train you in the proper mindset to help the form work. Then we will pick a high storm for the transformation.
Eshonai nodded. She would go through this training. In the meantime, she would consider. Perhaps there was another way. If she could get the Alethi to listen to her, find Dalinar Kholin, sue for peace. Perhaps, then, this would not be needed. Part 2. Wind's Approach. Shallan, Kaladin, Adolin, Sadius. 13. The Day's Masterpiece. War form is worn for battle and reign, claimed by the gods, given to kill. Unknown, unseen, but vital to gain, it comes to those with the will. From the Listener's Song of Listing, 15th Stanza. The wagon rattled and shook its way across the stone ground. Shallan perched on the hard seat next to Bluth, one of the slab-faced mercenaries Tevlakov employed. He guided the Chull pulling the wagon and didn't speak much, though when he thought she wasn't looking, he would inspect her with eyes like beads of dark glass. It was chilly, but she wore a hat she'd found in Yasna's things against the sun just in case. She wished the weather would turn, and spring, or even summer, would come for a time. That wasn't likely in a place notorious for its permanent chill. Having improvised a blanket from the lining of Yasna's trunk, Shallan draped it over her knees and down to her feet, as much to obscure how tattered her skirt had become as against the cold. She tried to distract herself by studying the surroundings. The flora out here in the southern frostlands was completely unfamiliar to her. If there was grass, it grew in patches along the leeward sides of rocks, with short spiky blades rather than long waving ones. The rock buds never grew larger than a fist, and they didn't open all the way, even when she'd tried pouring water on one. Their vines were lazy and slow, as if numbed by the cold. There were also spindly little shrubs that grew in cracks and along hillsides. Their brittle branches scraped the sides of the wagon, their tiny green leaves the size of raindrops folding and pulling into the stalks. The shrubs grew prolifically, spreading wherever they could find purchase. As the wagon rolled past a particularly tall clump, Shallan reached out and snapped off a branch. It was tubular, with an open center, and felt rough like sand. "These are too fragile for high storms," Shallan said, holding it up. "How does this plant survive?" Bluth grunted. "It is common, Bluth," Shallan said, "to engage one's traveling companion in mutually diverting dialogue."
"I do that," he said darkly. "If I knew what in damnation half those words meant."
Shallan started. She honestly hadn't expected a response. "Then we are even," she said. "As you use plenty of words I don't know. Admittedly, I think most of them are curses." She'd meant it lightheartedly, but his expression only darkened further.
"You think I'm as dumb as that stick?"
"Stop insulting my stick." The words came to her mind and almost to her lips, unbidden. She should have been better at holding her tongue, considering her upbringing. But freedom, without the fear that her father was looming behind every closed door, had severely diminished her self-control. She suppressed the taunt this time. "Stupidity is a function of one's surroundings," she said instead.
"You're saying I'm dumb because I was raised that way?"
"No. I'm saying that everyone is stupid in some situations. After my ship was lost, I found myself ashore but unable to make a fire to warm myself. Would you say that I'm stupid?" He shot her a glance, but did not speak. Perhaps to a dark eyes, that question sounded like a trap. "Well, I am," Shallan said. "In many areas, I'm stupid. Perhaps when it comes to large words, you're stupid.
That's why we need both scholars and caravan workers, Guardsman Bluth. Our stupidities complement one another.
I can see why we need fellows who know how to light fires, Bluth said. But I don't see why we need people to use fancy words.
Shh, Shallan said. Don't say that so loudly. If the Light Eyes hear, they might stop wasting their time making up new words, and instead start interfering with the business of honest men. He glanced at her again. Not even a glimmer of humor in the eyes beneath that thick brow. Shallan sighed, but turned her attention back to the plants. How did they survive high storms? She should get out her sketch pad and... No. She blanked her mind and let it go. A short time later, Tavlakov called the midday halt. Shallan's wagon slowed, and one of the others pulled up beside it. Tag drove this one, with the two parshmen sitting in the cage behind, working quietly at weaving hats from reeds they'd gathered in the morning. People often ordered parshmen to do such menial work, something to make sure all of their time was spent earning money for those who owned them. Tavlakov would sell the hats for a few chips at his destination. They kept working as the wagon stopped. They would have to be told to do something else, and had to be trained specifically for each job they did. But once they were trained, they would work without complaint. Shallan had difficulty not seeing their quiet obedience as something pernicious. She shook her head, then held out her hand to Bluth, who helped her from the wagon without further prodding. On the ground, she rested her hand on the side of the vehicle and breathed in sharply through her teeth. Stormfather! What had she done to her feet? Painspren wiggled out of the wall beside her, little orange bits of sinew, like hands with the flesh removed.
Brightness, Tavlakov said, waddling her direction. I'm afraid we haven't much to offer you in the way of meals. We are poor for merchants, you see, and cannot afford delicacies.
Whatever you have will suffice, Shallan said, trying to keep the pain from showing in her face, though the spren had already given her away. Please have one of your men get down my trunk. Tavlakov did so without complaint, though he watched hungrily as Bluth lowered it to the ground. It seemed a particularly bad idea to let him see what was inside. The less information he had, the better off she would be. These cages, Shallan said, looking over the back of her wagon. From those clasps at top, it looks like the wooden sides can be affixed over the bars.
Yes, Brightness, Tavlakov said. For high storms, you see.
You only have enough slaves to fill one of the three wagons, Shallan said, and the parshmen ride in another. This one is empty and will make an excellent traveling wagon for me. Put the sides on.
Brightness, he said with surprise. You want to be put into the cage?
Why not? Shallan asked, meeting his eyes. Certainly I'm safe in your custody, tradesman Tavlakov.
Yes?
You and your men must be well acquainted with rough travel, Shallan said calmly. But I am not. Sitting day in and out in the sun on a hard bench will not suit me. A proper carriage, however, would be a welcome amelioration of this wilderness journey.
Carriage? Tavlakov said. It's a slave wagon.
Mere words, tradesman Tavlakov, Shallan said. If you please. He sighed, but gave the order, and the men pulled the sides out from beneath the wagon and hooked them up on the outside. They left off the back one, where the cage door was. The result did not look especially comfortable, but it would offer some privacy. Shallan had Bluth haul her chest up and inside, to Tavlakov's dismay. Then she climbed in and pulled the cage door shut. She held her hand out through the bars toward Tavlakov.
Brightness?
The key, she said.
Oh.
He pulled it out of a pocket, regarding it for a moment, too long a moment, before handing it to her. Thank you, she replied. You may send Bluth with my meal when it is ready, but I shall require a bucket of clean water immediately. You have been most accommodating. I will not forget your service.
Thank you?
It almost sounded like a question, and as he walked away, he seemed confused.
Good.
She waited for Bluth to bring the water, then crawled, to stay off her feet, through the enclosed wagon. It stank of dirt and sweat, and she grew nauseated thinking of the slaves who had been held here. She would ask Bluth to have the parchman scrub it later. She stopped before Yasna's trunk, then knelt and gingerly raised the lid. Light spilled out from the infused spheres inside. Pattern waited there as well. She had instructed him not to be seen, his shape raising the cover of a book. Shallan had survived, so far. She certainly wasn't safe, but at least she wasn't going to freeze or starve immediately. That meant she finally had to face greater questions and problems. She rested her hand on the books, ignoring her throbbing feet for the moment. These have to reach the shattered plains. Pattern vibrated with a confused sound, a questioning pitch that implied curiosity. Someone needs to continue Yasna's work, Shallan said. Eurythiru must be found, and the Alethi must be convinced that the return of the Voidbringers is imminent. She shivered, thinking of the marbled parchman working just one wagon over.
You continue?
Pattern asked.
Yes.
She'd made that decision the moment she'd insisted that Tevlakov head for the shattered plains. The night before the sinking, when I saw Yasna with her guard down. I know what I must do.
Pattern hummed, again sounding confused.
It's hard to explain, Shallan said. It's a human thing.
Excellent,
Pattern said, eager. She raised an eyebrow toward him. He'd quickly come a long way from spending hours spinning in the center of a room or climbing up and down walls. Shallan took out some spheres for better light, then removed one of the cloths Yasna had wrapped around her books. It was immaculately clean. Shallan dipped the cloth into the bucket of water and began to wash her feet. Before I saw Yasna's expression that night, she explained, before I talked to her through her fatigue and got a sense of just how worried she was, I had fallen into a trap. The trap of a scholar. Despite my initial horror at what Yasna had described about the parchment, I had come to see it all as an intellectual puzzle. Yasna was so outwardly dispassionate that I assumed she did the same. Shallan winced as she dug a bit of rock from a crack in her foot. More pain spren wiggled out of the floor of the wagon. She wouldn't be walking great distances any time soon, but at least she didn't see any rotspren yet. She had better find some antiseptic. Our danger isn't just theoretical, Pattern. It is real and it is terrible.
Yes,
Pattern said, voice sounding grave. She looked up from her feet. He had moved up onto the inside of the chest's lid, lit by the varied light of the differently colored spheres. You know something about the danger? The parchment, the Voidbringers? Perhaps she was reading too much into his tones. He wasn't human, and often spoke with strange inflections.
My return,
Pattern said.
Because of this.
What? Why haven't you said something?
Say, speaking, thinking, all hard, getting better.
You came to me because of the Voidbringers, Shallan said, moving closer to the trunk, bloodied rag forgotten in her hand.
Yes, patterns, we, us, worry. One was sent, me.
Why to me?
Because of lies.
She shook her head. I don't understand. He buzzed in dissatisfaction.
You, your family.
You watched me with my family? That long ago?
Shallan, remember.
Again, those memories. This time not a garden seat, but a sterile white room. Her father's lullaby. Blood on the floor.
No.
She turned away and began cleaning her feet again.
I know little of humans, Pattern said. They break. Their minds break. You did not break. Only cracked.
She continued her washing.
It is the lies that save you, Pattern said. The lies that drew me.
She dipped her rag in the bucket. Do you have a name? I've called you Pattern, but it's more of a description.
Name is numbers, Pattern said. Many numbers. Hard to say. Pattern. Pattern is fine.
As long as you don't start calling me erratic as a contrast, Shallan said. What does that mean? She asked.
I am thinking, Pattern said. Considering the lie.
The joke?
Yes.
Please don't think too hard, Shallan said. It wasn't a particularly good joke. If you want to ponder a real one, consider that stopping the return of the Voidbringers might depend on me, of all people. She finished with her feet as best she could, then wrapped them with several other cloths from the trunk. She had no slippers or shoes. Perhaps she could buy an extra pair of boots from one of the slavers? The mere thought made her stomach churn, but she didn't have a choice. Next, she sorted through the contents of the trunk. This was only one of Yasna's trunks, but Shallan recognized it as the one the woman kept in her own cabin, the one the assassins had taken. It contained Yasna's notes, books and books full of them. The trunk contained few primary sources, but that didn't matter, as Yasna had meticulously transcribed all relevant passages. As Shallan set aside the last book, she noticed something on the bottom of the trunk. A loose piece of paper? She picked it up, curious, then nearly dropped it in surprise. It was a picture of Yasna drawn by Shallan herself. Shallan had given it to the woman after being accepted as her ward. She'd assumed Yasna had thrown it away. The woman had little fondness for visual arts, which she considered a frivolity. Instead, she'd kept it here with her most precious things. No, Shallan didn't want to think about that, didn't want to face it. Pattern said.
You cannot keep all lies, only the most important.
Shallan reached up and found tears in her eyes. For Yasna. She'd been avoiding the grief, had stuffed it into a little box, and set it away. As soon as she let that grief come, another piled on top of it. A grief that seemed frivolous in comparison to Yasna's death, but one that threatened to tow Shallan down as much or even more. My sketch pads, she whispered. All gone.
Yes,
Pattern said, sounding sorrowful. Every drawing I've ever kept, my brothers, my father, mother, all sunk into the depths, along with her sketches of creatures and her musings on their connections, biology and nature. Gone. Every bit of it gone. The world didn't depend upon Shallan's silly pictures of sky eels. She felt as if everything was broken anyway.
You will draw more,
Pattern whispered. I don't want to. Shallan blinked free more tears.
I will not stop vibrating. The wind will not stop blowing. You will not stop drawing.
Shallan brushed her fingers across the picture of Yasna. The woman's eyes were alight, almost alive again. It was the first picture Shallan had drawn of Jasnah, done on the day they'd met. The broken soul caster was with my things. It's now on the bottom of the ocean, lost. I won't be able to repair it and send it to my brothers. Pattern buzzed in what sounded like a morose tone to her. Who are they? Shallan asked. The ones who did this, who killed her and took my art from me. Why would they do such horrible things?
I do not know.
But you are certain that Jasnah was right? Shallan said. The Void Bringers are going to return?
Yes, Spren. Spren of him. They come.
These people, Shallan said. They killed Jasnah. They were probably of the same group as Cabsal and as my father. Why would they kill the person closest to understanding how and why the Voidbringers are coming back?
He
faltered. I shouldn't have asked, Shallan said. I already know the answer, and it is a very human one. These people seek to control the knowledge so that they can profit from it. Profit from the apocalypse itself. We're going to see that doesn't happen. She lowered the sketch of Jasnah, setting it between the pages of a book to keep it safe.
14. Iron Stance. Made form meek for love to share. Given to life, it brings us joy. To find this form, one must care. True empathy, one must employ. From the Listener Song of Listing, 5th Stanza. It's been a while, Adolin said, kneeling and holding his shard blade before him, point sunken a few inches into the stone ground. He was alone, just him and the sword in one of the new preparation rooms, built alongside the dueling arena. I remember when I won you, Adolin whispered, looking at his reflection in the blade. Nobody took me seriously then, either. The fop with the nice clothing. Tinalar. Thought to duel me just to embarrass my father. Instead, I got his blade. If he'd lost, he would have had to give Tinalar his plate, which he'd inherited from his mother's side of the family. Adolin had never named his shard blade. Some did, some didn't. He'd never thought it appropriate, not because he didn't think the blade deserved a name, but because he figured he didn't know the right one. This weapon had belonged to one of the Knights Radiant long ago. That man had named the weapon, undoubtedly. To call it something else seemed presumptuous. Adolin had felt that way even before he'd started thinking of the Radiance in a good light, as his father did. This blade would continue after Adolin died. He didn't own it. He was borrowing it for a time. Its surface was austerely smooth, long, sinuous like an eel, with ridges at the back like growing crystals. Shaped like a larger version of a standard longsword, it bore some resemblance to the enormous two-handed broadswords he'd seen Horn-Eaters wield. A real duel, Adolin whispered to the blade. For real stakes. Finally. No more tiptoeing around it. No more limiting myself. The shard blade didn't respond, but Adolin imagined that it listened to him. You couldn't use a weapon like this, a weapon that seemed like an extension of the soul itself, and not feel at times that it was alive. I speak so confidently to everyone else, Adolin said, since I know they rely on me. But if I lose today, that's it. No more duels and a severe knot in Father's grand plan. He could hear people outside, stomping feet, a buzz of chatter, scraping on the stone. They'd come. Come to see Adolin win or be humiliated. This might be our last fight together, Adolin said softly. I appreciate what you've done for me. I know you'd do it for anyone who held you, but I still appreciate it. I I want you to know. I believe in Father. I believe he's right, that the things he sees are real, that the world needs a united Alethkar. Fights like this one are my way to make it happen. Adolin and his father weren't politicians. They were soldiers. Dalinar by choice, Adolin more by circumstance. They wouldn't be able to just talk their way into a unified kingdom. They'd have to fight their way into one. Adolin stood up, patting his pocket, then dismissing his blade to mist and crossing the small chamber. The stone walls of the narrow hallway he entered were etched with reliefs depicting the 10 basic stances of swordsmanship. Those had been carved elsewhere, then placed here when this room was built. A recent addition, to replace the tents that dueling preparation had once happened in. Wind stance, stone stance, flame stance. There was a relief with depicted stance for each of the 10 essences. Adolin counted them off to himself as he passed. This small tunnel had been cut into the stone of the arena itself and ended in a small room cut into the rock. The bright sunlight of the dueling grounds glared around the edges of the final pair of doors between him and his opponent. With a proper preparation room for meditation, then this staging room to put on armor or retreat between bouts, the dueling arena at the war camps was transforming into one as proper as those back in Alethkar. A welcome addition. Adolin stepped into the staging room, where his brother and aunt were waiting. Stormfather, his hands were sweating. He hadn't felt this nervous when riding into battle, when his life was actually in danger. Aunt Navani had just finished a glyph ward. She stepped away from the pedestal, setting aside her brush pen, and held up the ward for him to see. It was painted in bright red on a white cloth. Victory? Adolin guessed. Navani lowered it, raising an eyebrow at him. What? Adolin said as his armorers entered, carrying the pieces of his shard plate.
It says safety and glory, Navani said. It wouldn't kill you to learn some glyphs, Adolin.
He shrugged. Never seemed that important.
Yes, well,
Navani said, reverently folding the prayer and setting it in the brazier to burn.
Hopefully you will eventually have a wife to do this for you, both the reading of glyphs and the making of them.
Adolin bowed his head, as was proper while the prayer burned. Pelion knew this wasn't the time to offend the Almighty. Once it was done, however, he glanced at Navani. And what news of the ship? They had expected word from Yasna when she reached the shallow crypts, but none had been forthcoming. Navani had checked in with the harbormaster's office in that distant city. They said the wind's pleasure had not yet arrived. That put it a week overdue. Navani waved a dismissive hand.
Yasna was on that ship.
I know, Aunt, Adolin said, shuffling uncomfortably. What had happened? Had the ship been caught in a high storm? What of this woman Adolin might be marrying if Yasna had her way?
If the ship is delayed, it's because Yasna is up to something, Navani said. Watch. We'll get a communication from her in a few weeks demanding some task or piece of information. I'll have to pry from her why she vanished. Better send that girl some sense to go with her intelligence.
Adolin didn't press the issue. Navani knew Yasna better than anyone else. But he was certainly concerned for Yasna, and felt a sudden worry that he might not get to meet the girl, Shallan, when expected. Of course, the causal betrothal wasn't likely to work out, but a piece of him wished that it would. Letting someone else choose for him had a strange appeal, considering how loudly Danlin had cursed at him when he'd broken off that particular relationship. Danlin was still one of his father's scribes, so he saw her on occasion. More glares. But Stormit, that one was not his fault. The things she'd said to her friends? An armorer set out his boots, and Adolin stepped into them, feeling them click into place. The armorers quickly affixed the greaves, then moved upward, covering him in two light metal. Soon all that remained were the gauntlets and the helm. He knelt down, placing his hands into the gauntlets at his side, fingers in their positions. In the strange manner of Shardplate, the armor constricted on its own, like a sky eel curling around its rat, pulling to comfortable tightness around his wrists. He turned and reached for his helm from the last armorer. It was Renarin. "You ate chicken?" Renarin asked as Adolin took the helm. "For breakfast. And you talked to the sword?" "Had an entire conversation." "Mother's chain in your pocket?" "Checked 3 times. Navani folded her arms. "You still hold to those foolish superstitions?" Both brothers looked at her sharply. "They're not superstitions," Adolin said, at the same time Renarin said, "It's just good luck, aunt." She rolled her eyes. "I haven't done a formal duel in a long time," Adolin said, pulling on the helm, faceplate open. "I don't want anything to go wrong." "Foolishness," Navani repeated. "Trust in the Almighty and the heralds, not whether or not you had the right meal before you duel. Storms. Next thing I know, you'll be believing in the passions." Adolin shared a look with Renarin. His little traditions probably didn't help him win, but, well, why risk it? Every duelist had his own quirks. His hadn't let him down yet. "Our guards aren't happy about this," Renarin said softly. "They keep talking about how hard it's going to be to protect you when someone else is swinging a shard blade at you." Adolin slammed down his faceplate. It misted at the sides, locking into place, becoming translucent and giving him a full view of the room. Adolin grinned, knowing full well Renarin couldn't see the expression. "I'm so sad to be denying them the chance to babysit me."
"Why do you enjoy tormenting them?"
"I don't like minders."
"You've had guards before."
"On the battlefield," Adolin said. It felt different to be followed about everywhere he went.
"There's more. Don't lie to me, brother. I know you too well."
Adolin inspected his brother, whose eyes were so earnest behind his spectacles. The boy was too solemn all the time. "I don't like their captain," Adolin admitted.
"Why?"
"He saved father's life." "He just bothers me," Adolin shrugged. "There's something about him that is off, Renarin, that makes me suspicious."
"I think you don't like that he ordered you around on the battlefield."
"I barely even remember that," Adolin said lightly, stepping toward the door out.
"Well, all right then. Off with you. And brother?"
"Yes?"
"Try not to lose."
Adolin pushed open the doors and stepped out onto the sand. He'd been in this arena before, using the argument that though the Alethi codes of war prescribed duels between officers, he still needed to maintain his skills. To placate his father, Adolin had stayed away from important bouts, bouts for championships or for shards. He hadn't dared risk his blade and plate. Now, everything was different. The air was still chill with winter, but the sun was bright overhead. His breath sounded against the plate of his helm, and his feet crunched in the sand. He checked to see that his father was watching. He was, as was the king. Satius hadn't come. Just as well. That might have distracted Adolin with memories of one of the last times that Satius and Dalinar had been amiable, sitting together up on those stone steps watching Adolin duel. Had Satius been planning a betrayal even then, while laughing with his father and chatting like an old friend?
Focus.
His foe today wasn't Satius, though someday, someday soon, he'd get that man in the arena. It was the goal of everything he was doing here. For now, he'd have to settle for Salinor, one of Thanadol's shard-bearers. The man had only the blade, though he'd been able to borrow a set of the king's plate for a bout with a full shard-bearer. Salinor stood on the other side of the arena, wearing the unornamented slate-gray plate, and waiting for the High Judge, Bright Lady Isto, to signal the start of the bout. This fight was, in a way, an insult to Adolin. In order to get Salinor to agree to the duel, Adolin had been forced to bet both his plate and his blade against just Salinor's blade. As if Adolin weren't worthy, and had to offer more potential spoils to justify bothering Salinor. As expected, the arena was overflowing with light eyes. Even if it was speculated that Adolin had lost his former edge, bouts for shards were very, very rare. This would be the first in over a year's time. "Summon blades," Isto ordered. Adolin thrust his hand to the side. The blade fell into his waiting hand 10 heartbeats later, a moment before his opponents appeared. Adolin's heart was beating more quickly than Salinor's. Perhaps that meant his opponent wasn't frightened and underestimated him. Adolin fell into wind stance, elbows bent, turned to the side, sword's tip pointing up and backward. His opponent fell into flame stance, sword held one-handed, other hand touching the blade, standing with a square posture of the feet. The stances were more a philosophy than a predefined set of moves. Wind stance, flowing, sweeping, majestic. Flame stance, quick and flexible, better for shorter shard blades. Wind stance was familiar to Adolin. It had served him well throughout his career. But it didn't feel right today. "We're at war," Adolin thought as Salinor edged forward, looking to test him. "And every light eyes in this army is a raw recruit." It wasn't time for a show. It was time for a beating. As Salinor drew close for a cautious strike to feel out his opponent, Adolin twisted and fell into iron stance, with his sword held two-handed up beside his head. He slapped away Salinor's first strike, then stepped in and slammed his blade down into the man's helm. Once, twice, three times. Salinor tried to parry, but he was obviously surprised by Adolin's attack, and two of the blows landed. Cracks crawled across Salinor's helm. Adolin heard grunts accompanying curses as Salinor tried to bring his weapon back to strike. This wasn't the way it was supposed to go. Where were the test blows, the art, the dance? Adolin growled, feeling the old thrill of battle as he shoved aside Salinor's attack, careless of the hit it scored on his side, then brought his blade in two-handed and crashed it into his opponent's breastplate like he was chopping wood. Salinor grunted again, and Adolin raised his foot and kicked the man backward, throwing him to the ground. Salinor dropped his blade, a weakness of Flame Stance's one-handed posture, and it vanished to mist. Adolin stepped over the man and dismissed his own blade, then kicked down with a booted heel into Salinor's helm. The piece of plate exploded into molten bits, exposing a dazed, panicked face. Adolin slammed the heel of his foot against the breastplate next. Though Salinor tried to grab his foot, Adolin kicked relentlessly until the breastplate too shattered. "Stop! Stop!" Adolin halted, lowering his foot beside Salinor's head, looking up at the High Judge. The woman stood in her box, face red, voice furious.
"Adolin Colin," she shouted, "this is a duel, not a wrestling match!"
"Did I break any rules?" he shouted back. Silence. It struck him, through the rush in his ears, that the entire crowd had gone quiet. He could hear their breathing. "Did I break any rules?" Adolin demanded again.
"This is not how a duel—"
"So I win," Adolin said. The woman sputtered.
"This duel was to three broken pieces of plate. You broke only two."
Adolin looked down at the dazed Salinor. Then he reached down, ripped off the man's pauldron, and smashed it between two fists. "Done." Stunned silence. Adolin knelt beside his opponent. "Your blade?" Salinor tried to stand, but with the breastplate missing, doing so was more difficult. His armor wouldn't work properly, and he needed to roll onto his side and work his way to his feet. Doable, but he obviously didn't have the experience with plate to perform the maneuver. Adolin slammed him back down to the sand by his shoulder. "You've lost," Adolin growled.
"You cheated,"
Salinor sputtered.
"How?" "I don't know how. It's just—it's not supposed to—"
He trailed off as Adolin carefully placed a gauntleted hand against his neck. Selenor's eyes widened.
You wouldn't.
Fear Spren crawled out of the sand around him. My prize, Adolin said, suddenly feeling drained. The thrill faded from him. Storms he'd never before felt like this in a duel. Selenor's blade appeared in his hand.
Judgment,
the High Judge said, sounding reluctant,
goes to Adolin Colin, the victor. Selenor Evid forfeits his shard.
Selenor let the blade slip from his fingers. Adolin took it and knelt beside Selenor, holding the weapon with pommel toward the man. Break the bond. Selenor hesitated, then touched the ruby at the weapon's pommel. The gemstone flashed with light. The bond had been broken. Adolin stood, ripping the ruby free, then crushing it in a gauntleted hand. That wouldn't be needed, but it was a nice symbol. Sound finally rose in the crowd, frantic chattering. They'd come for a spectacle, and had instead been given brutality. Well, that was how things often went in war. Good for them to see it, he supposed, though as he ducked back into the waiting room he was uncertain of himself. What he'd done was reckless. Dismissing his blade? Putting himself in a position where the enemy could have gotten at his feet? Adolin entered the staging room, where Renarin looked at him wide-eyed.
That, his younger brother said, was incredible. It has to be the shortest shard bout on record. You were amazing, Adolin.
Thanks. He handed Salinor's shard blade toward Renarin. A present.
Adolin, are you sure? I mean, I'm not exactly the best with the plate I already have.
Might as well have the full set, Adolin said. Take it. Renarin seemed hesitant. Take it, Adolin said again. Reluctantly, Renarin did so. He grimaced as he took it. Adolin shook his head, sitting down on one of the reinforced benches intended to hold a shard-bearer. Navani stepped into the room, having come down from the seats above.
What you did, she noted, would not have worked on a more skillful opponent.